Hazel Kahn with North Fork Works, where I get to meet my interesting, lively neighbors and introduce them to each other. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce you to Ms. Eleanor Morris Lingo of Southold, whom I'm meeting for the first time. Welcome to North Fork Works, Ms. Lingo.
Thank you.
I'm really happy to have you here. You told me that when you were 14, that would have been in 1940, you were a schoolgirl in Southold, and on the way home from school, you'd sometimes stop in at the Southold Presbyterian Church Cemetery.
So when I used to walk to school, sometimes I'd walk on the town hall side, and sometimes I'd walk near the cemetery. So, I don't know, out of for a kid, I guess, I used to read the tombstones. And under the tree, there was a little tombstone that said, Negro Slave Lady. So I said, as a kid, there were people of color before us.
You felt a particular connection to this grave, and in 1954, your mother died. You were 28. You made a Christmas wreath for your mother's grave, and then also a small wreath for the grave that you had first come across when you were 14. You continued this ritual every Christmas anonymously until in 1991.
36 years later, every year I placed that wreath. And nobody knew who did it. Well, one day, my sister happened to be talking to the town historian, Tony Booth, that knows us very well and know me, and my sister told her. So when she revealed this to Tony, of course, she was happy after 36 years that they finally found out who was laying the wreath. So Tony told the story to the Suffolk Times. And they wrote it up, the mystery lady, after 36 years, they found out who has been decorating the grave, and they named a big story. That was history in the town of Southold.
Now that we know how you became part of Southold's history, let's go back to your own history.
I was born in Southold, New York, April the 24th, 1926. My family, my father arrived here from Virginia, and my mother. 1920, from Virginia to make a better living here north. There were seven children. I had an older brother, Levi, and then a sister, another brother, Clarence, and then my sister, Alice. Then it was twin boys, Vincent and Daisman. Then I came along and a sister, Virginia.
So you're the second youngest.
So I was the second youngest. Born and raised in Southold, I attended Southold School. Back there, we didn't have a kindergarten, but I went right into the first grade, and I graduated in 1944.
Let's talk about your parents again. So your father came north to make a better life, which, of course, is what all the migrants right now who are flooding Europe from Syria and so on. That's what they want, a better life. What kind of life did he find here?
He worked on a farm, the Benjamin Tuttle Farm. Then he worked for a building company. Southold was building up then, and there was a lot of new buildings going on. So he started working for them. And then he retired. You know, he got older, so he didn't work any longer. So he took a few lawns that he mowed. And, you know, he was famous for the very active in the nutrition site as an elderly person for the senior citizens. The nutrition program was a Southold senior, you know, nutrition center where all the elderly people here went in Mattituck on Pacific Street. And of course, he encouraged everybody, all the elderly people, not to just sit home by themselves, but to get out and meet people, which he did. And they loved him so much. Everybody loved my father. And they made him a delegate to represent the Southold Senior Club in Albany, New York. Mm. So he went there and he represented the town. Of course, while he was there, they visited a few. But his comment was that Southold Nutrition Center was the best.
The best.
What years were these?
This must have been like maybe 1972, before that.
You haven't mentioned your mother.
Well, my mother passed in 1954 after having seven children. And, you know, they were all delivered in the homes. She had a midwife and so forth, but under the doctor's care. Mm-hmm. But she delivered all the children at home.
And you think that was took a toll on her health?
I think it took a toll on her health because she had high blood pressure, an enlarged heart. But we didn't know this. My mother was always a cheerful person. And if you'd say to her, well, how do you feel? She'd say, oh, I'm fine, thank you. And never let on that she was actually as sick as she was until her death, and she had a diary. And we read in the diary where she had all these complications.
So she told her secrets to her diary.
To her diary. And so that was when we found out.
And she wrote every day in the diary? Or
every day in the diary, a little something, you know, about how she was and so forth and so on. She was just a housewife. She took care of the family. She did not work.
We shouldn't say just a housewife, right?
No, I shouldn't say just a housewife because that's a bigger job than out there really working. But she was a housewife raising us.
And so she just kept it to herself because she didn't want anyone to worry.
Right, right.
And did she go to a doctor?
We knew that she was under the doctor's care because she went to a doctor in Brooklyn. My father would take her in the car because we always had a car. So my father would take her. It was such an old car, must have been an old Buick with the rumble seat in the back. And of course, we as children were ashamed to be in this old car. So we would, you know, hide down in back of the car and my father would make us sit up. He said, don't be ashamed because at least we had a car.
What was the shame about?
Because it was an old car. That was the only reason, because it was an older car. Hmm. But it took us everywhere as we wanted to go at All that right. time.
You're one of the few people, I think, around who can really talk about what Southold was like in those days for an African-American, which African-American is a new, relatively new word, right?
Right, right, yes. Then in the years that I came, we weren't referred to as Afro-Americans. We were Negro, or then it went to Black, and it seems like nobody was satisfied with what we really was. When I came along as a child, we were Negro.
So what was it like to grow up as a Negro in Southold?
Well, I tell you the truth, as me growing up in Southold, you know, there was some prejudice, but as a child, my best girlfriend was a little white girl. Mm-hmm. And Betty and I would always do things together. If she had to go to the store for her mother, I went for her with her mother. If I needed something, she would go with me for my mother. And we were very close. We knew that there were prejudice in the town, but as children, we didn't recognize it. So when I graduated from high school, we had a class reunion, and Betty then could tell me, and she said, Eleanor, now I can tell you, the town people in Southold always was on her mother about why she let her play with the Morris children. And her mother told them that the Morris children didn't teach her anything wrong. And they were a very lovely family.
Was your mother friendly with her mother?
Well, we were neighbors. And I mean, we said hello, goodbye, but not running to each other's houses.
You never had a cup of tea or...
No. She never, no. But as neighbors, neighbors were lovely. But a new road was going through. My father, they were going to move his house. Or he had to build a house. And he went to one of the farmers in town and asked him, would he sell him some property so he could build a home? He told him he didn't have any, but he had acres. Mm. But he didn't want to sell the property to my father. So then there was a neighbor, Mrs. Hodgin, and she just loved my father. So she said, listen, I'm going to sell you a piece of property.
She was white, presumably.
Oh, yes, she was a white lady. So she said, I'm going to sell you a piece of property. And she did. Mm. And my father built the home.
Did you have children?
No, I don't have any children. No, okay. Just have nieces and nephews that are very close to
me. You've got six siblings, right?
Oh, yes.
Are they all still thriving? Very.
No, not the older ones. Everybody has passed All my family has passed, but one sister, my baby sister, and I, we are left.
But you have their children.
Oh, yes.
As your family. So then you graduated high school, and then...
When I graduated from high school, of course, there was no work around here. So like the other people, they and the students, they all left if they wanted to have a better life. So I went to Bridgeport, Connecticut. I had an aunt there, and so I lived with her. I applied for the F.W. Woolworth Company as a sales girl. But at that time, they didn't have any sales girl jobs open. So they said, well, we do have a job here in the candy stock room. So if you'd like to do that, you'll help a lady there. That whatever the occasion was, we would make baskets and bag candy and so forth and so on. So after, I don't know, a few months, a sales girl job opened up. So I was the first sales girl of color in the F.W. Woolworth Company in Bridgeport.
What year was that?
I had to be in 45 like that.
And you were the first person
of color? I was the first person of color hired there. I was on the glassware counter. Then I had to buy for the glassware company whatever I thought would sell. Then I would put the orders in.
So you became a buyer?
I became a buyer for that department.
So how long did you work there at Woolworths altogether?
Maybe about 2 years, maybe.
How was Bridgeport in those days in terms of color?
They had the GE company and all that. So the people of color, they didn't have a hard time getting a job there, as far as I know. Our block was mixed. And I've always lived among a mixed community. Then I moved down, I left there, and I came down to New York. I could have stayed there, but I had a sister and a brother in Brooklyn. So I figured, well, maybe, you know, I could move down there and maybe do a little better. We were in East Flatbush, beautiful location. We were by the Botanical Gardens and the Brooklyn Museum. We were able to walk there. And my sister was in personnel. When my mother passed, she came out because my father was more or less alone and needed somebody to be with. So she came out. And she got a transfer from her position over to Plum Island. So when she got to Plum Island in personnel, she encouraged all of the men of color or women to come and work over there. So they were encouraged. Maybe they wouldn't have started working there, but she encouraged them.
What was the story on Plum Island in those days? What kind of place was did people think it was?
The town people didn't really realize that it was a safe place. They were doing experiments and so forth. But when my husband was called over there, then I knew what was going on. If they were with the animals and so forth, they had to take showers. If they moved from one room to the next room, they had to take showers. It was safe over there. People didn't realize it was such a secret, but they wasn't telling what it was really like. It was a safe place. When my husband went over there, I mean, he was working with the animals.
What was he doing with the animals?
He was actually taking care of, you know, all the animals came over there and they never went back. They would have a deer, the cows, the cats, or whatever the doctors needed. Maybe they needed a heart out of one of the cats. It was very hard for my husband because he's a very caring person. And he was getting attached to these animals. And when they wanted one, you know, he felt like it was one of his children, one of his pets. So
you were the first person of color F.W. Woolworths.
Yes. Every job that I went on, I was the first person of color that was hired. And the reason I left here because, you know, I was like a business person. I loved arithmetic and so forth and so on. When I went to Bridgeport, while I was working at F.W. Woolworth, I was going to evening school. And I was keeping up with the additions and spelling and so forth. So when I got down to New York, I went to an employment agency for a position. So when I went down for this interview, old rickety stairs that I had to climb up. So I just said, oh, I don't want to work here, but they've sent me here, so I'm going to go for the interview anyway. So I went in, and this young lady came. Oh, hello, Miss Morris. And I said, oh, hello. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, it's been filled." She doesn't know I'm looking right through. I know what's happening because she saw me as a color. After that, I went to Decca Records and I worked there. And of course, I was the first person of color in that position in the bookkeeping department. I stayed there. They moved from Manhattan. They were moving to California. Then the next thing I know, my husband had come out here and he was out here a year. So got a call that Eastern Long Island Hospital needed someone for their business office. And there again, I was the first person of color there in the business office. Nobody saw me because I was in the business office. And I retired from there in 1991.
Eleanor Morris Lingo, 89-year-old Southold native, is telling us about her life and work. This is Hazel Kahn on North Fork Works on WPKN Radio. Please consider donating at WPKN.org to keep this program and all our varied music and public affairs programs on the air. There are two ways you can do this, with a single one-time donation or with a monthly donation, which means you then become a WPKN sustaining supporter. Either way, we thank you very much.
1991's, how old were you?
Oh my God. Born in 26, so 91.
65 or something?
Yes.
Yes. That was your last job, basically.
Oh yes, I retired from there.
You told me the person who, I don't know, someone was working there and said, "You must be very happy to be leaving."
Oh yes. So when I had my exit interview, I had a chance to tell them all of this stuff that I had bottled up. So I was able to tell them how I
what
felt.
What did you tell them?
And I said, my final thing is, you'll never hire another person of color in this business office. And that's the saddest part that I'm leaving on. And do you know what? It took them 7 years before they hired another person of color.
I'd like to know how today you're how old?
89.
And you've lived through all of these years, 89 years, and you've seen a lot of changes ever since Obama became president, right? There's been much more talk, I think, than usual about racial equality.
Mm.
I'm just wondering, how do you see it? You know, you're not working now, though you were involved in the community, right? You're involved with the church.
Oh, yeah, the church, and I was on the CAST board. I'm on Anti-Bias Task Force. I'm a member there. I'm the Secretary Treasurer for the South Hope Iconic Senior Club. So I'm involved. I stay involved.
So how would you say it's different now, living in South Hope, than it was, I don't know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago?
There's still prejudice in the town of South Hope. Well, you know, when you're dealing with people, and like I go to some of the activities, you can see.
What do you
see? I can recognize that people don't really like, they don't like the position that I'm a woman of color, and they don't like, I guess, that I am active like I am. And people, a lot of the people, they just, you know, they love me. I mean, but you can see, you know. Even when I came back to South Hole, when I was looking for a house, I had a hard time. Mm. There was a house up for sale with a big for sale sign on it. And I made an appointment to see it. Well, they didn't know, because they can't figure out what lingo is. They don't know whether it's Chinese, Italian, or what.
You said there's still prejudice in South Hole.
Oh, yes.
You can see it.
Yes, you can see it. Not that much, but it is there.
Can you give me an example? What do they do? I mean, the person who's prejudiced, how do you know?
The way they look, or maybe some of the things that, you know, they don't know they're saying, but they don't realize, you know.
But it still hurts you.
You know what? I'm so used to it now that it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, notice it.
Yes, you can notice it.
I'm curious how you see the developments in the United States now, this year, last year, the whole Black Lives Matter.
Oh, yes, they matter.
How do you see it?
You know, well, I can see anything the president wants, they knock it. A blind man can see anything, any idea he comes up with, they don't like it and they knock it, whether it's going to be good for the country or not. That's because he's black. Right. And a lot of people just don't like it. You know, they don't want to say it, but they might as well say it.
So when I said Black Lives Matter, I mean, how do you see that movement that's going on in Ferguson, in Baltimore? And
I think it's terrible. First off, the police. They don't even give you a chance. Well, sure, our lives matter, just like anybody else. We shouldn't have to say Black Lives Matter.
But do you think it's good that they're doing this? Do you support what they're doing, or you think they're doing it properly or wrongly, the whole...
Oh, they're definitely wrong. I mean, they don't treat us right. We shouldn't have to say it. We shouldn't have to have this movement. All lives matter. So why do we have to fight for what is equally ours? I mean, even when we say the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, I mean, when you get to that, we pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and then we get to the part that all are equal. It's hard for some of us people of color to say it.
Is it? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is hard. And the younger people are not going to put up with what we older people. I mean, they're going to fight for what they think is right, where we used to just turn the cheek. And, you know, we believe in prayer. I mean, the older people. But the younger people, they have minds of their own.
Any of your nephews and nieces, are any of them active in anything like this?
Oh, no. No, they're not. I mean, you know.
Would you want them to be?
I want them to get it because, you know, not to have to fight for it, because we should have the privilege just like anybody else. I mean, white people don't have to fight. They're white.
These things that you're active in, the community things, are you active in the black community, in the church community?
Well, of course, my church is first as far as I'm concerned with my life. My church is first. So the other things, you know, I just do. I'm a Baptist. Yes. I belong to a church in Riverhead. Friendship Baptist Church. Reverend McElroy is my pastor.
Okay. Your church comes first.
Oh, yes.
And it's presumably a mainly black church.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, my husband belongs to Presbyterian Church in Southold. Mm. It's what you want to associate with.
You know, I've had a lot of trouble with this, my radio program, trying to find people in the black community to talk to me. It just doesn't happen. I've had three or four people. They said, okay. And then they never call me back. They never answered my... They just didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do it for reasons that I'm not sure. I mean, I can understand not wanting to be out there. And it's the same with, say, my Russian immigrant people that I know. They don't want to do it. Uh-huh. There's also a language problem. And same with the Latino community. So I interviewed Sister Margaret as the sort of spokesperson for them. Uh-huh. So how much of your social and other life is in a black community? Or what can you tell me about the black community on the North Fork and South Old Riverhead?
You know, I guess it's because maybe some of the people of color, maybe they don't, I don't know. I've asked them to come to meetings and so forth. But maybe they're afraid of speaking out. I don't know. Because even when we have the Martin Luther King program, I have a hard time getting the people of color to come.
Where, at the church?
To the churches. I don't know why, you know, they don't come. I've begged them, I've asked them, and things, you know, that we do have, they just don't. I think it's because they're kind of afraid. Like one time my husband and I was coming from New York and the police stopped us. It was 2:00 in the morning. My husband and I don't drink. And I guess they think that all the people of color drink and get drunk or whatever. But we were coming from New York. We had to pick up my niece from the airport. Well, the policeman followed us. We knew he was following us from Mattituck to Southold. My husband don't drive over the speed limit anyway. I could jump out of the car sometime. He puts on the light, and the light goes on, and I said to my husband, oh, dear, you better pull aside. He's for us. So I finally talked him into pulling aside, and the policeman comes up. So he says, where are you coming from, New York? That's how he greeted us. So my husband said, no. So I guess he wanted to say none of your business, you know. Well, have you been drinking? Well, I smell something. So you don't say anything. And you're afraid to say anything because I'm sitting there bawling because I want to say, if you smell something, it must be you. You know, you must be smelling yourself. But I couldn't see a badge or anything. And then he said, well, go on, you were wobbling. Now, if you know a cop is behind you, would you wobble? You're afraid. Are you afraid to say anything?
So you think that's maybe some of the reason that people of color, I don't used to call people, them people of color.
Yeah, right,
you didn't like to say black, right?
I don't care. Oh,
okay,
it doesn't bother me.
That they don't come to some of the things you ask them to come to, like Martin Luther King.
Right, right.
They don't come because they're afraid of...
the repercussions.
I mean, what might the repercussion be? That
I went to have my car cleaned. Somebody stole the car, and the car was all dirty and filthy inside. And I went to South Hole to have them clean the car up. And they said they were going to do a good job of whatever they were going to, and whatever they told me that they were going to charge me, I was willing to pay because I wanted the car clean. So when I went to pick up the car, I wasn't satisfied. So I said to the guy, the owner, I said, I'm not satisfied the way you did my car. He was trying to tell me blah, 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 was all right and whatever and whatever. And he pushed me. And I said, well, I'm going to call the police. He said, well, call them. They're my friends. They're not going to do nothing. So I said, wait a minute. You know, and that's when I said I was going to call the police. I said, well, you pushed me. He said, well, you cursed at me. I don't curse. I don't even know how to curse. And he said, well, you cursed at me. I didn't curse nothing. And there was a black fellow that was working there, and he heard this conversation. And he couldn't say anything. Finally, I wasn't convinced. I didn't like it. I paid him. And I'm going out, and the black fellow is out there. And I said to him, you heard him tell me that I cursed him. He said, well, I want my job. And I could understand. He couldn't say a word. He knew that the man was wrong, but he couldn't say anything because he was afraid. And I don't blame him. He needed his job. If these little things happen to you, me, I don't dwell on them. I just push them aside and say, well, hey, I'm all right now.
But you also speak your mind.
Oh, yes, I speak my mind. And I'm not afraid to. I mean, that's one thing. They know I speak my mind.
Yeah.
If I have
to. So these other people, they just think that if they do anything controversial.
Right, right.
They'll stand out and somebody will.
Right, right.
Something bad will happen to them.
Right, right.
Even though they're not sure what.
Right, right. They just are afraid, you know.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lingo, for spending this time with me and my radio program.
Well, it's been more delightful for me to be interviewed by you. Just a thought that you would ask me after all these years.
Thank you again very much. It was lovely.
Well, you're more than welcome. And thanks for asking me.
That was Eleanor Morris Lingo, 89-year-old South Hold native, talking about living and working as an African-American woman through the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and on until the present day. North Fork Works is heard on the first Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. All North Fork Works programs are archived on hazelcar.com and produced by Tony Ernst.